This week, an interview with Commissioner of Indian Affairs Morris Thompson of Tanana. Potlatch, a program about Alaska Natives for Alaska Natives.
Ira Hayes, Ira Hayes, call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore, not the whiskey drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war. Gather round me, people, and a story I will tell about a brave young Indian you should remember well. From the tribe of Pima Indians, a proud and peaceful band who farmed the Phoenix Valley in Arizona land. Down their ditches for 1,000 years that sparkling water rushed, till the white man stole the water rights and the running water hushed. Now Ira's folks were hungry and their farm grew crops of weeds. But when war came, he volunteered and forgot the white man's greed. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian or the Marine that went to war. Well, they started up Iwo Jima Hill, 250 men, but only 27 lived to walk back down again. And when that fight was over and Old Glory raised, among the men who held it high was the Indian Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war. Ira Hayes returned a hero, celebrated through this land. He was wined and speeched and honored, and everybody shook his hand. But he was just a Pima Indian, no water, no crops, no chance. At home nobody cared what Ira'd done, and when do the Indians dance? Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian nor the Marine that went to war. Then Ira started drinking hard, jail often was his home. They let him raise the flag there and lower it as you'd throw a dog a bone. He died drunk early one morning alone in this land he'd fought to save. 2 inches of water in a lonely ditch was the grave for Ira Hayes. Call him drunken Ira Hayes, he won't answer anymore. Not the whiskey drinking Indian or the Marine that went to war. Yes, call him drunken Ira Hayes, but his lands, they're still as dry. And his ghost, it's a lion thirsty in the ditch where Ira died.
Peter Lafarge singing about Ira Hayes. Next on Potlatch, a nostalgic look at the legendary bush pilots with Frank Brink.
Alaska has challenged the ingenuity and stamina of pioneers for many generations, producing famous explorers, sourdoughs, dog mushers, and the canniest flyers who ever took to the air, the legendary Alaskan bush pilots. Only a few are left, and they all have stories to tell that would add gray hairs to the sturdiest of men. One such story was told by bush pilot Jack Jefford, a big man with a rough gentility who flew in Alaska before radios, instruments, and controlled airways, and yet is one of the men most responsible for development of instrument flight in Alaska. One day, while Jefford was flying an old Gullwing Stinson, 100 miles east of Nome, he hit the granddaddy of all downdrafts.
Well, I was up probably 3,000 feet, and then it just started down in a downdraft. I just stayed borne into the wind. The next thing I knew, I was in this ground drift, and I felt an awful jar on the airplane. And I put the flaps down. I don't know why, but it's something to another lever to turn. I didn't want to just sit there. And the doggone thing was shaking, and I was trying to fly it. And finally, I thought, my God, I must be down. I began easing the throttle off and finally idled it, and it still seemed like I was flying. And I'd hit this mountain top, and it never hurt the prop even. And there I was, perched there.
The old Stinson was one of the earliest to carry a radio. In fact, Jeffords' radio had been installed shortly before he went down.
So the next night, the signals ran real good, and I'd send this SOS and then tune slowly across the band and listen. My gosh, it just hit me right in the ears. I hear this call. And I established communication, told him I was down, I was okay, and that as best I knew, I was somewhere between Galvin and Elam.
This coincidence resulted in Jeffords' rescue 7 days later and proved the value of radio in air rescue. Sooner or later, every old-time flyer talks about Noel Ween, the soft-natured dean of Alaskan bush pilots. This was the case one day when Jeffords said,
"There's a story about Noel Ween that I think is one of the best stories I have ever heard."
Jeffords told a hitherto unpublished story. In the summer of 1935, Will Rogers and Wiley Post crashed on takeoff near Point Barrow. Immediately, the world wanted to know what happened. The Associated Press hired Al Lohman of Nome to get pictures of the crash at all costs. Lohman got the pictures, and Noel Ween flew them from Fairbanks to Whitehorse. From there, he planned to take off the next morning and fly Lohman with the pictures to Seattle. It was then they learned that a rival news service had gotten the same pictures and were already in Juneau, ready to take off for Seattle. Lohman, knowing his pictures would be worthless unless they beat the rival news service, induced Ween, Alaska's most conservative bush pilot, to consider the greatest calculated risk of his career. An interesting recording experience resulted when Ween was enticed into telling this story about himself. In a combination of the two, Noel Ween in Fairbanks and Jack Jeffords in Anchorage, here is the first recorded version of one of the most daring and dramatic experiences in northern flying.
But I didn't like the idea much. I hadn't flown at night, so I wanted to be conservative, you see, no matter what the deal was or how much money. Now we had 650 miles to go direct over the mountains all the way. And I didn't like the idea at all, but Al Lohman kept saying, "Well, it's now or never. We might just as well go back to Fairbanks if we don't go now." So, well, I guess we better risk everything. It was starlight, but no moonlight.
And then Noel, I can just see him go off by himself, and all these things are going through his head. And then in his soft-spoken way, he says, "Well, I'll do it." And he had a little hand wobble pump, and they stuffed this blanket full of gas cases.
And the little field at Whitehorse then wasn't very big, and a dirt runway. Pan American station manager there drove down at the other end of the field and just turned his car lights towards us. So all I had to do was head straight for the lights. I couldn't see anything, see, but the lights. And we finally got off. I didn't know whether it was going to make it. It was a hairy deal anyway, in the dark, see. And we got off, all right, but turned a little to miss him. There was absolute darkness from there on, and we couldn't see the ground at all. It was all dark below, timber covered, of course. It would have been a bad deal if the engine had quit. Well, Bob Ellis took off from Juneau on floats, and he got as far as Vancouver, B.C., and then he was just so completely pooped he couldn't go any farther, and he stayed there overnight. That's the only thing that saved us. We arrived in Seattle in Boeing Field just 2 hours ahead of Bob Ellis. And old Al Lohman was right, but it was a risky deal, I'll tell you.
There's one pilot whose personality has no counterpart, the puckish, irrepressible Archie Ferguson, with the heartiest laugh that ever monopolized a joke. Archie's stories are legend. One of his favorites is the experience of hauling his first passenger the day after he got his pilot's license.
Well, anyway, I got my license. I come home and I picked up this Jimmy Denovan in Deering. So I told him, I said, well, I can't pack no baggage. And if you want to go, I can take you just the way you are. So, but, geez, he had a bunch of clothes, see? And I said, well, I can't pack no baggage. So he said, wait a minute, I'll put them all on. So he put on three pair of pants. One right on top of a couple of coats and sweaters, and we started out, see? So we went to land at Chudnik, where the CA is, and I missed that bend, and I landed the next bend. So then I couldn't steer it. The wind was blowing so hard that Great Lakes couldn't steer, so I made him get out and run behind, you know, and steer me. And boy, when we get out the store, he was just water just running off of him, see, with all his clothes on. So my mother and dad was living there, you know, and geez, an airplane to them was something awful. I stayed about an hour, and I had to go right back to custody. See, so I got about Rabbit Mountain. Jesus started to snow, and I turned around, and I beached it back up there, and the wind had changed, see? So I let it down, wind, and geez, I never stopped rolling. I went way down around the bend. So I came up, and geez, I give the folks hell, see? I said, geez, can you see me fly over? Make smoke. How you expect me to fly around here else? I know which way the wind's blowing, see? And, you know, about an hour later, it looked good, and I tried her again, see? Went down near that farm, Jesus worth, and I came back, and geez, I went over to the store there where the CA is. The folks lived there, you know, and I seen the biggest cloud of smoke roll out I ever saw in my life. Boy, she was right on the ball, mother was. So I landed, and we were drinking coffee, and Papa said, say, now I guess I'll go put on my pants. He said, I was changing pants when you blew over. I'll go get him. So I heard him upstairs. He said, say, Claire, where's my pants? Oh, she said, was that your pants? When Archie flew over, I put him in the store.
Other all-time great pilots like Bob Reeve, Ray Peterson, Mudhole Smith, Sig Ween, Bob Ellis, Terrence McDonald, Gordon McKenzie, Oscar Underhill, Shel Simmons, and unnamed others round out today's still living Hall of Fame in Alaskan bush flying.
This record produced in the early 1960s. The Legendary Bush Pilots with Frank Brink. Thanks to KIAN, Kiana, Alaska, for carrying Potlatch. We'll hear the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Morris Thompson of Tanana, after this message.
Fire is a problem shared by every community. That's why everyone should give some thought to what action to take if fire suddenly strikes. Underwriter Laboratories, the fire safety people, believe that knowing how to operate a fire extinguisher could be a decisive factor in dealing with minor fires. Underwriter Labs explains that the Type A extinguisher is designed for wood, paper, cloth, rubber, and some plastics that may serve as fuel for fire. The Type BC extinguisher is one designed to snuff out fires caused by flammable liquids, greases, or gases, as well as those created by electrical equipment that is still energized. And UL points out that the multi-purpose fire extinguisher can be used on all these kinds of fire. Remember that most extinguishers require a pin to be pulled before they will operate, and that the nozzle should be pointed at the base of a fire's flames. UL hopes you will know what to do when the fire strikes. Sometime in your life, you may need to know.
I'm Morris Thompson, was born and raised in Tanana, Alaska, community 150 miles west of Fairbanks here. Attended all 8 grades there. Went on to high school at Mount Edgecombe for 4 years and was graduated in 1959. Following that, attended the university for several years, then took an electronic technology course in Los Angeles, came back to Fairbanks and worked at Gilmore Creek for 4 years as satellite tracker. Following that, worked for 2 years in state government, then with Governor Hickel, worked an additional year to 19 months in Washington, D.C. as a staff assistant to then Secretary Hickel on the dealing with Alaska Native problems and with the American Indian problems. Returned to Alaska to assume the area directorship in 71 and was there until I was appointed commissioner in 74.
I asked the commissioner if he found more differences or more similarities in the situations of Alaska Natives and Native Americans of the lower 48.
There are many similarities, and similarities, maybe it would be easier to break out the differences in the similarities. Similarities are, one, the Alaska Native community until just recently I had very severe health problems, chronic unemployment, lacked educational opportunities. Those three areas were somewhat true in the lower 48 as well. Although the totality of the Indian community, we have some exceptions to that general rule. The differences are the Alaska Native community now has, I think, some great promise in developing the Native Claims Bill that will address all three of these issues and improve, hopefully, the quality of life for the individual Native in Alaska. The relationship between my bureau and the American Indian and the Alaska Native is somewhat different. In the lower 48, we're a trustee over the Indian lands and resources, which means that we assist in managing the resource. In Alaska, the land and the resources, the surface and subsurface, vest solely with the Alaska Native community with assistance from the Bureau if they want it. So that is some of the major differences between the Indians of the Lower 48 and the Alaska Native community.
Commissioner Thompson outlined the housing services the BIA provides Alaska Natives.
We have two programs, one called a HIP program, a Housing Improvement Program, which is a small program basically to try to bring substandard housing up to a decent living standard. We have a new construction program, again, that's very small. I would be quick to point out that the Bureau Housing Program is not intended to address the entire housing needs of the Alaska Native community. That should be done through another agency, Housing and Urban Development. We now are launching a new program up here of bringing 500 units to different communities, 500 units of housing, to different communities in Alaska, and a joint cooperative effort between Housing and Urban Development and the Bureau of Indian Affairs to try to solve some of the housing needs. So that's a new program that we're just launching. We have 500 units spread throughout Alaska. In the Fairbanks area, we have, I believe, Fort Yukon, Northway, or Tanacross. I'm not sure of the two communities, but I believe there's three or four communities in this region that will participate. The houses are designed, they're small, low-income housing. They've been designed, tested in the Arctic over the last couple of years to solve some of the unique construction problems we have up here, and that's settling and condensation problems during the winter months. And I think the design that we have goes a long way toward addressing those problems. But we're working with Native regional housing authorities to implement the act, and they're playing a key role in working between the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Housing and Urban Development.
Some Minto residents said their houses, built with government assistance, were built poorly. How will the BIA build better houses than those built at Minto?
The houses in Minto were constructed jointly. The Alaska State Housing Authority constructed a majority, if my recollection is correct. The Bureau of Indian Affairs constructed homes for the elderly and for people and for some other people. Of course, one of the things that has always been a construction problem is what design techniques to use to get around the condensation problems, what design techniques to use to get around the frost heave problems, and how can you build a quality home with the amount of money that we have to work with. This is true for all federal agencies. So I guess one of the things that has consistently come up is this problem of having low prototype costs and high construction costs and trying to keep the financial package within everybody's means. As an example, there was supposedly 1,200 units for 5 years to equal 6,000 units in Alaska, and that whole effort ran into problems because the prototype cost, the cost per unit, was excessive and no one could buy it. The cost for each individual unit was prohibitive. What we've done now is utilize some Bureau designs, which is a smaller house, and HUD dollars to match the two to try to solve the problem. And it's only on an experimental basis, the 500 units.
I asked the commissioner if there are still Native high school students sent to high school in Chemawa, Oregon, and Chilaco, Oklahoma.
There are no students now. We have a few students who elected to finish in Chemawa. I believe they're from Barrow. Other than that, there are no students outside the state of Alaska. We have about 400 students at Mount Edgecombe, and the growth of the education in rural Alaska was just as you explained it, in that where we have very small communities of, say, 100 people, and we only have four or five high school students. The state, who has the primary constitutional responsibility of providing education for all Alaskan children, native or non-native, obviously would not be able to go in and build a high school. So they've gone to a boarding home concept or a dormitory concept, attending public schools. We now see another trend. The state and both the Bureau are moving to regional centers, Bethels, Barrows, Gnomes, Kotzebues, Tananaws, Galenas, communities like this, and constructing facility. And the students from that region coming into those communities and living in private homes and attending school and then returning home for the summer is the way we're addressing it now. And there's problems with that, you know. I've always maintained that it's exceedingly difficult to provide education in that setting where you take youngsters away from home at a very critical age in their life and then put them in a dormitory and try to give care and love, something that can only be gotten in the home, I think, is one of the most difficult things that I think we're trying to do in education in Alaska, and it's a tough set of facts. I must say, I had very positive experiences with it. I loved my home. I returned to Tananaw very often, but I also enjoyed meeting kids, a large group of kids of my own age at Mount Edgecombe. At one time, the state, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, operated at well over 100 day schools in Alaska. We're now down to 53, and that has taken place over the last couple of years, 8 to 10 years. That will continue. The state, in the last 2 or 3 years, haven't assumed that many schools from the Bureau. I don't believe they're in a financial position to do so. But we stand ready to work with the state or with the local community to provide education. The direction is to move toward the total state assumption because it is their constitutional responsibility, and we think that's the right way to go.
Commissioner Thompson told me about his recent trip to Western Alaska.
I had a what has to be unique for a Commissioner of Indian Affairs coming from Washington, D.C., to witness a reindeer drive from Nome to Kotzebue. I flew over it yesterday. They're herding 943 animals from Nome to Kotzebue using three snow goes, taking a two-week period. And as you know, reindeer was introduced into Alaska by the Lohman brothers in a reindeer drive along the coast of Alaska up into that region. So I didn't see the first, but I was able to see the second drive. Kind of exciting and a lot of fun.
I asked the commissioner if Alaska Natives have enough power to influence the events, forces, and agencies that affect them.
Well, I think more and more that's happening. I think through this media, radio, through television, through the press, through the Native Claims Bill, more and more decisions are being made at the local level, and that's one of the objectives of our administration and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. But aside from that, the people in the villages have some dollars to address some of their social or economic needs through the Native Claims Bill. They're given a management corporation that they themselves control. They have now an effective clout in state government.
Commissioner Morris Thompson, Bureau of Indian Affairs. Here now, the St. Louis Jazz Quartet.
When you're weary, when you're feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I'm gonna dry them all. I'm on your side. When times get rough and pain's around, just like a bridge over drive. Oh yeah, oh yeah. Well, when you're down and out, when you're on the street, and the evening falls falling so hard, you know that I'll comfort you. I'll take your part.
Potlatch, produced in the studios of KUAC in College in cooperation with KTOO Juneau, KOTZ Kotzebue, and KYUK Bethel, under Title I of the Higher Education Act.